Well, I think that the legislature has to stand by it, and that's one of the reasons I'm on this fact-finding mission to do just that, to find out what we need to do to back up the position taken by the city. And I would hope that we're able to do that, hold our ground on that, and turn around at least the department. And if it takes legislative action to clarify our taxing policies, we'll do it. I want to also, while I've got the opportunity here, because I know we have listeners in Cordova, assure people that I'm going to be over there this afternoon, this evening. My next stop is in Tetitlik. I need to meet with some folks in Tetitlik because they have not been informed by Exxon on a lot of the activities going on, and they're very concerned, and I'll be then coming over there and to hopefully attending with the commissioner of DEC and the other reps, listening in more, trying to learn and listen from the public as to what is exactly going on and what type of plans that they're in. They're in a mode of a defensive mode now. They used to be in an offensive mode, but they've now moved into a defensive mode of dealing with this problem, which means that they're going to try to isolate the impact to targeted areas where they can hold off the oil from going into the Esther Island hatchery area, the San Juan hatchery. And let me tell you, that drives a fear and shock into everybody's heart just to even think about that, because that's the breadbasket area that we saw as our livelihood last year when it came to fisheries. And it's going to be real important that we do that, and we're going to hear about that in a minute. But Dave, the people of Cordova are sitting like the people of Valdez and wondering what is ultimately going to come out of it. And the bottom line is Exxon's going to be responsible. They've assumed that responsibility. I've been impressed with Exxon's forthrightness in that area. I guess they're being a little cautious about the tanker, you know, talking anything about the tanker liability of the pilot or the master in this case. But I think that's probably understandable under the situation and the potential litigation that may come out of it. The National Transportation Safety Board meeting, unfortunately, I understand it's been scheduled for Anchorage, and I'm going to try my best to encourage the administration and the hopefully if we get an opportunity to see the presidential group that's coming in today, to encourage them to have a hearing here in Valdez, because obviously there's cab drivers that come in contact with these tanker people, there's bartenders, there's people who have known for years what's occurred with regard to the tanker crews. And I'm not pointing any fingers at any individuals, but at least that information ought to be shared with everybody, and I'll be put into a form where everybody can get it. So I don't think that they'll get the full story if they hold their hearing in Anchorage.
I noticed that while we've been talking, you have an overflight or a map done based on an overflight this morning. And the most startling revelation, I think the most disheartening news we've had so far, is that so much of the oil evidently has passed between the islands, Naked Island, Eleanor Island, and Night Island, to the west side. Last night this time it appeared that the slick was going to be concentrated between Montague and Night Island, heading for Montague Strait. It seems now that a great deal of it is over on the west side of Night Island and approaching the areas over on the western part of the sound. You flew over that this morning. Is there any way to estimate whether the bulk of the slick is still over to the east of Naked Island and Night Island, or how is the distribution from what you can tell in your overflight?
It appears to be equally divided on both sides, predominantly on the seaward side of Night Island. I'm not an expert in it. I attended a briefing about an hour ago with the observers, and they are the ones that mapped this morning. And it's unfortunately now on both sides, and that's the reason they're going to have to go in and do some defensive containment and protecting several of the very sensitive areas that have been identified by the fishermen. And Jack Lamb and others have coordinated it with DEC, and they're targeting those areas that need to go for protection. And I think that's a very encouraging note. I guess that was probably my next observation, was is that I was very impressed with Department of Environmental Conservation's activity here, with the Department of Fish and Game, and with the Exxon representatives, and with all the agencies involved. They're sitting down as a team working through these problems one-on-one, and that's an encouraging note. Let me just say that there's no question in my mind that we were extremely caught off guard. We're understaffed, undermanned here in Valdez and DEC, and we've known that for years. Now, I hope that's the next thing I'm able to impress upon my colleagues in Juneau, that we can't afford to continue to cut DEC budget. I mean, we've literally pulled in every DEC rep that's available from around the state to man this one problem, and, you know, it's a major problem. It's a catastrophe, but to not have the staffing here to be able to react and monitor what's going on is unexcusable, and to a certain degree, the state of Alaska has to assume some blame for this because we've allowed the DEC complement and the organization here to be slivered away or just trimmed down to almost nothing. So somebody says, well, why didn't you know more? Why didn't you monitor more of what's going on? Well, let me tell you, the reason you're not doing it is because we haven't got the state DEC staffing that we've needed here, and adequate staffing is hopefully going to come as a result of this because the pipeline's going to be here for another 20, 30 more years, and it's you know, we can't afford this every 10 years to go through it. It's just not acceptable.
All right, well, State Senator Mike Szymanski speaking with us in the Valdez Civic Center Ballroom. For those stations down the line, anticipated coming up in just a few minutes is a press briefing organized by the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. I suspect there will be many other agencies represented as well. And also we were told by Don Cornett from Exxon that Frank Irasi, the president of Exxon Shipping, will be present as well. We're going to take a break from the Valdez Civic Center. I want to thank KCHU volunteers, Donna Lavick-Wiesenberg, and Mary Beth Joyce, and Lee Schmidtline, and Kim Hartman for their participation in this broadcast. Anchoring the broadcast at KCHU Studios is James Winchester. I'm Dave Hammack. We'll be back after update on weather conditions for Prince William Sound. Shortly after 12 o'clock, we'll be back with more live broadcast from the Valdez Civic Center. This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network. Thank you, James. Frank Irasi, the president of Exxon Shipping, has arrived. We will begin the press conference, I suspect, in just a matter of moments. Just a couple of notes. The previous conferences, the last couple of days, have been punctuated by the sound of airplanes, huge airplanes, flying over and landing and taking off. Today, that sound is absent due to the high winds in Valdez. We're not... flying takeoffs have been prohibited at the Valdez Airport, which will impact, of course, the cleanup operation. The waves also are picking up. We can see Port Valdez from the windows of the Civic Center here in the main Valdez, and we have white caps in the port, which is fairly unusual. The press conference is about to begin. Frank Irasi is on the podium, and we will anticipate the conference to get underway. Everyone, of course, waiting to hear the results, or really what the Exxon plan is today in the use of dispersants, whether the wind is picked up to the point dispersants can be used, whether flying conditions allow it. There also are beginning to be reports, some of them conflicting, but reports that the wave action in Prince William Sound is beginning to affect the Exxon Valdez as it sits on the reef. One of the great fears, of course, is that the remaining million barrels of crude oil on board the vessel may be spilled if the vessel were to further break up or to be disturbed and it's resting on the reef. That is the greatest concern at this time, is for the million barrels of oil still remaining on board the vessel. The press room is filling up. As I said, Frank Irasi, president of Exxon Shipping, is at the podium, and we anticipate the conference will get underway. Earlier this morning, we heard from the NTSB, basically identifying and clarifying their role, and from the Court of Fishermen this morning. And here is Frank Irasi of Exxon Shipping.
The National Transportation Safety Board has started its investigation, and Exxon is cooperating fully. While the investigation is going on, we feel it's inappropriate for us to comment any further on the events involving the accident itself. Exxon's priorities right now, in fact they have always been, transferring the remaining cargo from the Exxon Valdez to prevent any further spillage, to salvage the ship safely, and to clean up the spilled oil. And we're addressing all three of those priorities simultaneously. All of our efforts and all of my comments will be focused on these three priorities. What I'd like to do this morning is to address three specific areas. Firstly, I'd like to give you an update, a status report on all the activities that are going on right now. Secondly, for the first time, I'd like to give you my personal assessment or judgment or feeling of where we stand and how things are going. And thirdly, I'd like to address your questions regarding the oil spill activities and the salvage operations. I will need to ask that we limit the press conference to about a half hour. There are an awful lot of activities going on right now in the response and salvage. Some of them are very critical, and I need to stay on top of them. As you know, the weather became very uncooperative last night. By 2 a.m. In the morning, the wind gusts had increased to 70 miles per hour. I understand the wind blew a large portion of the roof off the terminal building at the airport. I also understand that the alert response of the Valdez police and of a number of the personnel from the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation saved a number of helicopters out at the airport. They were in the process of becoming airborne without anybody on them. And they literally laid themselves across the pontoons and drove trucks on them. So, I think when we look back at all of this, that's going to become a very important point that they were able to do that for us. Those choppers are critical to our response efforts, and if they were damaged, we would have been in even deeper trouble. As a result of the high winds, the FAA totally shut down helicopter operations this morning. That's probably why I have all the TV cameras in front of me now. We have no assessment of the slick location. Certainly, we believe it's moving in the southerly direction in response to the high winds. My understanding was that we were hoping to get permission to lift off at 10:15 and begin our mapping and tracking operations. We received a warning of the high winds at about 9 p.m. last night and moved very quickly to secure all of the skimming operations. Some of our booms were damaged. However, all of the skimming equipment is intact and undamaged. The containment boom around the vessel was damaged, and our number one priority this morning is to get that boom back in place. Two large mechanical skimmers from the Navy have arrived and are being deployed. This will bring the total number of skimmers in operation to 12. A second C-130 spray plane arrived in Alaska last night. We plan to begin dispersing operations in Zone 1 late this morning. We were shut down because we couldn't get the helicopter control plane in the air. Actually takes two planes to do the dispersing operation. We normally would expect to use a helicopter as a control vehicle and then the C-130 fixed wing. When we weren't able to get off the ground a helicopter, we shifted our control plane to a fixed-wing aircraft, and we're now airborne, and I suspect the operations may have already begun. We're moving in additional dispersant from stockpiles in the U.S. and the U.K. We have also begun production of additional dispersant at one Exxon chemical plant in Houston and a second chemical plant in the United Kingdom. Our response team, our Exxon response team, has now grown to well over 100 members. I was supposed to get the exact figure when I left, but I apologize. I do know that there are at least seven more Exxon personnel en route this morning, and these are all managers, supervisors, advisors, key people to the operation. So the team is growing by the hour. We had 90 members of cleanup crews available at 6 o'clock this morning to begin cleanup operations. They are currently on standby waiting for the weather to improve. We have to move most of these people out to sites by small boat and that wind is hampering us. Of the 90 people, 60 are VCO and 25 are NORCOM. You may recall we had a little issue about union and non-union. We feel we have resolved that to everybody's satisfaction. We intend to hire at least 25 new local workers each day as we develop new areas for them to begin the cleanup. Last night, during the worst of the high wind gusts, the vessel pivoted approximately 12 degrees to the north. It's now resting at a heading of about 295 degrees true. I understand from the people on board that that was not a very pleasant feeling as the vessel was pivoting, but their feeling this morning is that the new position feels much more stable than the original aspect we had immediately following the grounding. So they had a few anxious moments, but right now they feel much better about it. We presently have three submersible pumps in operation. The transfer rate has increased to 3,600 barrels an hour. We have four additional pumps that will be placed in operation during the next 6 to 24 hours. We should reach at least 10,000 barrels an hour transfer rate by tomorrow morning. As of 12 noon today, we have transferred 100,000 barrels of cargo. That's 10% of the volume on board when we started this operation. That may not seem like much, but to us, it's a very positive step forward. We hope to have about 95% of the cargo off the vessel in 3 to 4 days. We have some other very encouraging news. We have determined that we are able to maintain buoyancy in number 4 starboard ballast tank. And that's full buoyancy in number 4 starboard ballast tank, and we are able to maintain partial buoyancy in number 2 starboard ballast tank. To put that in perspective, all of the tanks, there were 5 tanks along the starboard side that were damaged. 3 of those tanks contained cargo. 2 of them were ballast tanks and were empty at the time of the impact. One of our biggest problems in keeping that vessel afloat is that we need to restore buoyancy, particularly along the starboard side. The fact that we have now are able to control the flooding totally in number 4 starboard and partially in number 2 starboard ballast tanks is very encouraging news to us. Okay, let me shift to, rather than facts, let me shift to feelings. My gut feeling, the feeling of my key people. We are gaining confidence by the hour. Now, we have an enormous problem that we're dealing with. If you can just step back a moment and think of someone giving you a problem to solve and telling you, Frank, you've got a 200,000-ton tanker resting on a pinnacle, something like a weather vane, and you need to figure out how to get it off. And by the way, you've got 240,000 barrels of oil on the water in an extremely sensitive environmental area. You need to get the oil off the water. By the way, you know that tanker I told you about a few minutes ago? It's got 1 million barrels of oil on it. You've got to keep it from getting out. Same time, you've got to communicate to all of the local people who are very concerned and rightfully concerned, and you've got to keep the press informed and the world informed of what's going on. You've got a whole bunch of concerned state agencies and federal agencies, and you've got to figure out how to keep them all together because we need everybody moving in the same direction to get our hands around this thing. By the way, you've got to do them all at the same time. We are gaining. big problem. We got a lot ahead of us, but we are gaining confidence. Deep down, we're beginning to feel that we will be successful in getting that oil out of that vessel. We will be successful in safely refloating the vessel. I got to be honest with you, there's no way I can keep the oil from impacting more beach area. This wind is really working against us in that respect. I obviously can't guarantee you that I'm going to get the oil out of the vessel and that I'm going to refloat the vessel. We are constantly adjusting to upsets and disappointments, equipment breakdowns, much higher winds than we anticipated, the total shutdown of helicopter operations. But we've become a pretty hardened bunch, and we are adapting quickly to changes in circumstances. More importantly, in spite of all of this, we believe that we are gaining on some very critical aspects of this problem. The coordination is improving noticeably between ourselves, the Coast Guard, NOAA, and the Alaska state agencies. We're beginning to move and act like a team, and that's very important to the overall recovery. And we're beginning to view this whole problem as an oil spill recovery problem and a ship salvage problem rather than a catastrophe. I mean, when we first came here, I have to tell you, quite frankly, we were a little overwhelmed. But our focus is changing, our feeling is changing. We are now viewing it as doable segments, and we're addressing it with all the determination that we can. We still have a major problem ahead of us. It's an enormous challenge, but we feel that we are gaining. In football terms, we're on the 10-yard line, but we got the ball and we're moving forward. 10-yard line might not be much, but quite frankly, the first 24 to 36 hours, we were in a goal line stand. So we're gaining confidence. That's all I got right now. I'd like to address your questions. Yes.
On that same personal score, there is the sense that you personally are a pretty angry man because some people in your company who've been promising the people of Alaska that they would you keep their waters clean have failed to do so.
Well, I don't sense any anger, personal anger. You know, my attention and my focus has been on trying to get our arms around the problem. And, you know, people could say, why aren't you interested in knowing more about what happened? I am interested. Why aren't you interested in learning other aspects of how the ship got to where it is? I am interested. But I can't do anything about them. That's reconstruction of history. My attention is being focused on the things that we can impact and that we have to impact right away, getting the oil off and getting the ship refloated, getting the oil off the water.
How much oil
was there? There really was very little oil in the boom. I understand from a visual aspect that it's important to see that boom around the ship. But let me be quite frank with you. We got 240,000 barrels in the water. There's probably less than 5,000 in that boom. So visually it's important. I know emotionally it's important, but there's so much out beyond the boom. I should have just told you that I don't know.
Sir, have you informed the people who are out there cleaning up of its toxicity level and of proper measures that they can take to protect themselves while dealing both with the liquid and the fumes coming off it and handling the oil?
I certainly believe we have. We are very, very conscious of their safety.
There are notices posted all over Alaska that their employees cannot go out without taking measures to protect themselves. And I have talked to chartermen and fishermen who are coming back to town physically ill because no one is providing them with any equipment to protect themselves.
I don't want to have to make a claim 5 years down the road because we have medical problems. I want something done.
Fine. We'll get on.
Sir,
And my other question is also the lack of vessel problem on hauling equipment out. And I've spoken with charter operators who've been sent out with one crowbar. They made a trip all the way out with one crowbar. Why aren't we hauling other things at the same time?
You know, there are a lot of activities going on, a lot of activities.
What do you say to fishermen who say that even if you magically cleaned up the sound tomorrow, that like the measuring by the botulism scare a few years ago, there's no way that you can prevent substantial commercial harm to fish coming from this area? People simply aren't going to buy it because they've heard all this bad publicity. What do you say to fishermen about that?
Right now, I don't say anything.
Why are there...
That doesn't mean I don't want to, and it doesn't mean that we have to respond to it, but right now I'm addressing myself.
Mr. Iorossi, why have there been no attempts to move
women? Yes, there's a gentleman right here.
Once the water does clear, what are we talking about in length of time in cleaning up the oil on the water?
Well, right now...
Years?
Right now we have no estimate. Because, and the reason is because we haven't really seen the rate at which the dispersion will work. We haven't really seen the rate at which the burning will progress. The only thing we've seen is very limited skimming operations. So it's hard to begin. It's hard to begin. Yes, we're going to clean it up. It's going to be cleaned up.
Are we talking about years though from now?
Well, I'd certainly say we're talking about months. You know, when we talk about cleaning up, we mean cleaning up beaches, cleaning up rock impact. That's going to be months of activity.
Did you say the months today?
Yes.
How much?
I really don't know. You know, we've been interrupted by... our plan was first thing in the morning, we would begin dispersing in Zone 1. We would begin burning in the most precarious areas, I mean precarious from potential beach encroachment, and we would continue with an upgraded and expanded skimming operation. At the same time, we'd be booming the sensitive areas. That's what the plan was, all to start 6 o'clock this morning. Actually, where we are is the skimming was shut down, the burning was delayed, and the dispersion was delayed. But the dispersion activity should be underway right now. The burning activity is either underway right now or will begin in the afternoon.
They're starting to burn. Have you taken any attempt to move the people out of the villages of Elamar and Tetitlik?
Yes, we're very conscious of that.
Are you conscious of it, or are you actually moving people out? These volatile hydrocarbons are known. They are one of the most extensively studied group of compounds. They are known to be carcinogenic, mutagenic, and teratinogenic. These people should have been moved out immediately.
The Alaska DEC is very conscious of that. That's their primary. That's one of their primary responsibilities in a team effort, and they're advising us. So we are on top of it. I can't give you minute details of what we're doing.
They're already. What about women who are pregnant, say? And who approved the
burn?
They should be gone already.
The state of Alaska. We have not had any surveillance because we haven't been able to get up in the air. Our hope was that by 10:15 this morning we would get FAA clearance to get up in the air. So right now...
One of the game plan is to move all the oil into one cove and kind of give up on that cove and not do anything about it. Is that true?
You know, that's always an alternative that's talked about in dealing with a spill, but right now there's no way we can herd that 240,000 barrels anywhere.
What percentage?
At this point, the only thing we can do with it is track it, try to determine its course, try to determine what the most sensitive potential impact areas are, and then try to prevent that impact.
Mr. Arlock, I'd like an answer.
We're not hurting it anywhere.
What can we do to protect the men that are out there working? I'd like an answer. We need to do something now. They're sick. My husband and other men are out there. They're getting physically ill.
The best answer I can give you, the best answer I can give you is that I will begin making everything happen that we can possibly get to happen. We don't want to hurt anybody. Right now we've done this activity. It's amazing. On the ship and all the activity, as far as I know, there's not a single injury. That's the way we want to keep it.
There are men who are coming to town that are dizzy and sick to their stomachs. And they've only been out there for an hour at a time.
That just means we got to come up with more protection for them. I don't know what is available, but I absolutely assure you I'll get right on it. I just don't have an answer for you right now.
Is there any further damage to it?
We don't know. There's no leakage at all. There's total equilibrium between the outside level, sea level, and the inside level in the tanks. The lowest layer is seawater, and that layer changes in depth with the tide, but there is no further leakage, and to our knowledge hasn't been for past day or so.
Mr. Rylowski, what relationship is there between your current efforts to clean up the spill and the original plans that the original contingency plans that Alyeska had, and also could you characterize the adequacy of those plans?
No, I can't.
How much relationship is there between what you're doing now and the original contingency plans that Alyeska had to deal with the spill?
Alyeska's oil spill response plan for a 200,000 barrel spill calls for immediate addressing of the use of dispersants by all the groups involved. It calls for testing of burn ignition. It calls for skimming. So all three of the activities that we are engaged in are in the plan. We didn't come here and dream up things. They are in the plan, and we are proceeding along that plan. Now, the plan requires certain specific clearances from the state, from the federal government, and we have gone through all those steps. You know, we are in a very controlled mode and a very cooperative mode at this point. We are continually interacting. This morning in our control center, besides the 50 or so Exxon people working different tasks, we had Admiral Nelson, we had Commander McCall, we had Larry Dietrich and Bill Lamoureux from the DEC, and it's just beautiful to see the cooperation that's going on.
What percentage of the oil slick is in the shipping lanes, and have you been given DEC permission to use the dispersant anywhere other than the shipping lanes?
We have permission to use dispersant in what's called Zone 1. Zone 1 is the area of deep water, just I think it's about 200 fathoms. It's just to the south of the area where the vessel is grounded. I believe that part of that Zone 1 includes a portion of the shipping lane, but I don't think it's the entire shipping lane. And Zone 1, I understand, is much broader than the shipping lane itself. I don't know, because we don't have a firm assessment of this.
I need to find out, are you slowing down the flow of oil through the pipeline, or have you stopped that totally? And when will tanker traffic be resumed again?
I'm just going to give you hearsay, because none of that is really part of my responsibility. I had heard that as of yesterday, the pipeline rate was down to 800,000 barrels a day rather than its normal 2 million barrels a day.
And how about the traffic? The
resumption of tanker traffic is under discussion. I was in a meeting for about 2 hours last night with the Lieutenant Governor, with a number of his aides, with Admiral Nelson, with Commander McCall, and one of the many topics that were addressed was when would the appropriate time be to begin tanker movements, and I think the best person to talk to about that is Commander McCall. That's really his responsibility in cooperation with a number of other agencies.
Will it have a short-term effect on the supply of oil in this country or the price?
I haven't read a newspaper or watched the TV news since I got here.
Are they running out of storage? Is that, in fact, the real reason?
Gaining confidence, but aren't you pretty disappointed about the way things have turned out today in terms of the weather? You know, last night you all were geared up, ready to go, and
I am disappointed that helicopters have broken down. I am disappointed that the weather turned out to be far worse than was forecast. I am disappointed that some things are not moving as fast as we would like, but in spite of all that, I am just elated to see progress. I am so happy to be moving forward rather than standing on that goal line. I expect that we will get many more disappointments and upsets. There's no way we could eliminate them. The important thing is to be ready to respond quickly when the circumstances change.
Is there a new concern arising, given that the oil's been in the water for as long as it's been? I understand that oil undergoes some changes with time.
I mean, as far as dispersants or burn, I understand that we're still well within the time frame at which we're going to have an effective dispersant and an effective burn.
Left, you figure, before it turns into the thick goo that everybody describes as being unmanageable.
I don't know. You know, you could say, let me just be more explanative here if I can. You could say, why don't you know? My scientific advisor's up in a helicopter, you know, there's just so much activities going on. I'm trying to touch the key points. My personal attention is almost at this point 75 or 80% on the lightering activities and the ship salvage activities. I've got so much expert help on the cleanup that I'm just kind of watching over their shoulder. But
if Exxon knew that the captain had a history of drinking trouble going back a number of years, why then was he pilot of a ship like that?
I have no intention to comment. You know, I said it originally when I started this, that all of that focus needs to shift to the NTSB. And we'll obviously comment when all that is out.
Your regulations. Are alcoholic beverages allowed on your tankers? And if
absolutely
so, what
not.
Are... Absolutely not.
Absolutely not.
All right. Thank you.
Can you say where the captain went when he left the bridge that night?
He went to his cabin, which is one level below the bridge and one flight of stairs.
But this was after the ship ran aground the first time?
No. There were not two groundings. The ship's log only shows one grounding.
And the captain was where at that time?
What we do know is when the vessel left the terminal, the captain was on the bridge. When the pilot was disembarked, the captain was on the bridge. Shortly after the drop-off of the pilot, he went to his cabin after turning the watch over to the third mate.
Why did you do that?
I don't know.
You have
to wait for the statements from the NTSB. And I really don't want to address any more questions about that.
Given what you know, go ahead.
What are the chemical constituents of the dispersant? There's discussion that this is an emotional issue. A part of the public's problem is we haven't been able to find out what the dispersant actually is, and that's why there's such a problem.
We had a scientist from NOAA, and we had an Exxon scientist here, and they went totally through that. I'm not a scientist, but let me pass on what I heard. The molecular chain is just about identical to soap. It's basically a surfactant.
It does not
add to the problem. In fact, the oil sitting on that water by itself has a greater toxicity than the oil and dispersant mixture.
Can you tell us what the name of the chemicals are? Can you tell us what the names of the chemicals are? If it's just soap, why aren't we being told what the actual names of the substances are?
There were two fellows here last night. Were you here last night?
Yeah, but unfortunately it's hard to ask questions with
okay. Those fellows, the ones you got to get to, one is Dave Kennedy with NOAA, the second is Al Mackey with Exxon. The individual who is now in the aircraft controlling the dispersant is also an expert in this. His name is Gordon Lindblom. I'll try to make one or all of those folks available to you tonight. but I'm a poor soul. I couldn't tell you what the chemical composition is.
Tell me what you know now about Auburn. And this is a statement that this first oil is less toxic than oil in the water. That is just totally misleading and incorrect, and that you should retract that.
Well, I'm not going to retract it.
It's inaccurate.
Okay. I think maybe you should talk to Dave Kennedy.
I have talked to Dave Kennedy.
Which we need to clear up, that's not the state's contingency plan, it's yours.
Yes.
It does say, let's
clear that. It's not my contingency plan. It's Alaska's contingency
okay,
plan.
Okay, now Alaska's contingency plan. I made a mistake. But it does state in here that the toxicity goes up with the use of this.
Let's get Al Mackey here.
That's not the question I want to ask. I want to ask a question about how much boom material do we have to physically start protecting the streams and creeks and bays down here in the direction that the oil is moving?
At the last time I checked on that, which was about a day ago, we had 13,000 feet in the water, 22,000 additional feet being deployed, and we had more on the way, but I don't have an exact figure. I'll try to get that for tonight.
What were the original figures of what they had on hand here for you to start with?
I don't know.
Can I get those figures, please? Can we call your office and get the figures?
Mr. Iorossi.
No, Alaska's not talking to anybody.
Mr. Iorossi, given what you know now about how hard it is to clean up a spill of this magnitude, do you think the oil industry was honest when it assured Congress and the public 10 years ago that they could handle a spill of this magnitude?
Let me just give you the same response to the same question that I gave to the Lieutenant Governor. You know, this is certainly the largest spill by far. I mean, many, many multiples of anything that anybody has handled. You know, up to this point, what people have been dealing with is an assumption of how you address it. For the first time, unfortunately, we have experience. I will have experience. I told Lieutenant Governor that I thought it was very, very logical that based on the experience that we develop here, that a lot of things be reassessed.
Could you answer the question, though? Do you think the industry was honest at the time in their assurances?
I don't know what was said. I was not part of that, so I really can't comment any further. But I certainly say that we will gain a lot of experience that will become the basis of a lot of the assessment.
Mr. Rossi, on your chart here, the last position of the ship shown at the grounding has the time group 0004 hours. Is that... Can we use that as the time of grounding?
Yes, that is the official time from the ship's log, and it's the only entry in the ship's log concerning grounding.
Is that Alaska time?
Yes, that's local time. That's right here.
Okay.
It was 4 minutes after midnight.
Okay. What happened to the other 4 hours from the time that the ship was boarded at 11:02 till the time it was reported as being aground at 0:04? That distance between where the ship was exchanged for the pilot and where it is approximately 30 minutes at 10 knots. There's about 3.5 to 4 hours there that are mysteriously hung up on a rock pile, don't you think?
I don't understand where you were getting that. The pilot was let up. The ship left the dock at Valdez at 22:15, I believe. No, 21:15. It dropped the pilot off at... I can go over to the chart because they're all marked there.
We're finally accounted for then. We're talking about the next day.
No, wait.
Aren't we?
No.
You said that the exchange was made at, okay, let's say it was $2,200. That's 10 o'clock. Is that correct? 10 o'clock p.m.? Is that correct?
This is the point.
Exactly, Rocky Point. That's easily within range of the radar at Potato Point.
Right here is 23:24. That is 11:24 p.m.
Okay, now
the vessel came to rest at 0004.
Okay, my question, sir,
is the time, what 4 hours? Will you please let me add for you? From 0004 to 23:24 is 40 minutes.
Okay, I'm sorry, it's my mistake.
40 minutes, folks.
Mr. Iorossi,
so sorry if I'm getting emotional. I'm just tired, but it's 40 minutes, not 40
Mr.
hours.
Mr. Iorossi, when you said that the ship pivoted last night, it was very close to the Baton Rouge yesterday. Was there any damage to the Baton Rouge?
None whatsoever.
In relation to the ship?
No, no.
Is the transfer still taking place today?
Yes, it was never interrupted.
How long did the Baton Rouge stay in place, sir?
Until we get 450,000 to 500,000 barrels off, which is the capacity of the Baton Rouge, and we've determined that there is sufficient depth for the ship to be submerged to the 450,000 to 500,000 barrel. That's about half of the volume that's on board. The Exxon San Francisco is at Knowles Point, ready to move in behind the Baton Rouge. It also has 500,000 barrel capacity. Those two ships together should be sufficient unless we begin to get a lot of oil and water mixture toward the end of the transfer, in which case we'll be moving more than just oil. We have a third lighter ship in place or en route for that eventuality. Exxon
Philadelphia.
Yes.
Can you please summarize again?
There's just some boom. There's just some boom that was damaged. I don't have any assessment of cost at this point. That's it's somebody's worry, but it's not mine. There is no reason for me to even be concerned about that right now. I have total authority to get this job done. There is no limit monetary on what I can do. There's no limit on my authority. I'm lifting planes into the air from all over the world. It's going to be a hell of a bill, but right now I'm not stopping to count.
What's the length of
the tow fence, Grandma? The last assessment was as of last night, and there are really two figures you got to focus on. One is the total impacted area, and as of last night, NOAA had that projection as 10 by 10 or 100 square miles. In the middle of that was the major slick, which is the area of total or nearly total oil coverage, and that was in the order of 12 to 15 square miles.
Okay.